wonder what it is that would make you believe. We're thinking about real proof that Jesus is Lord, that the Christian story is true, that God is there, that he loves you. What is it that would make you believe? I asked that question of an atheist friend of mine. I said, what would make you believe? And he'd clearly been asked the question before because he had an answer like that. He said, if God rearranged the stars in the heavens in order to spell out the Ten Commandments, then I would believe in God. I don't know where you would set the bar for proof of God. My friend set it to galactic heights. What is it that would prove that God exists? And as he said that to me, I had two thoughts simultaneously, which I hasten to add is a very rare occasion for me. You know, two thoughts a month is about my average, but somehow I'd had five coffees that day, and I had these two thoughts that were sort of jockeying for prominence. And the first thought was, you know what? The current arrangement of the stars is already miraculous. That was the first thing I wanted to sort of say to him. As we're going to explore in a second, the current arrangement of all those stars and the existence of us skeptics is an improbability, orders of magnitude, more improbable than stars happening to spell out Hebrew letters. When you have a look at the current arrangement of the heavens and our current existence within this universe, you start to realize we don't need to wonder what would happen if we were confronted with a miracle. We are living in one. I think Immanuel Kant once said that if the stars only came out once every 1,000 years, we would think it the most extraordinary miracle. The fact they come out every night makes us blasé about the whole thing. But no, the current arrangement of the heavens is already miraculous. I was going to go down that route with him. That was my first thoughts when he said he wanted the stars to rearrange. But then I had a second thought. And this is the one that I voiced. I just said to him, if God actually did rearrange the stars to spell out the Ten Commandments, would you like such a God? He said, oh no, I could never like God. But if he proved his existence, then I would have to submit. And I guess at that stage, me and my friend had common ground. Because the God in whom he did not believe, I didn't like either. If he thought the way that God would show up is basically by telling you to behave and writing his rules in the sky, if that's the sort of God that is there, I wouldn't like him either. But the God of the Bible is very different. He doesn't just rearrange the heavens in order to make you a good boy or a good girl. The God of heaven actually shows up in a really surprising way. While everyone's just looking up in the heavens for signs, he shows up in our midst. Last week, if you were here, we began in John chapter 1, this beginning of the biography of Jesus, the fourth gospel that's there in the New Testament. And it begins by saying, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. In the beginning, there's been an explanation of God. There's been a communication of God. Everything that God wants to say to us is wrapped up in a person. That's different, isn't it? A person who shows up, and John chapter 1 says, we've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. And you look at Jesus and you see that he's just love covered over in flesh, full of grace and truth. He shows up in our midst and he stoops and he serves and he suffers and he bleeds and he dies on that cross. It's stunning the way that God actually shows up in the Bible. All throughout John's gospel, you get Jesus saying, I'm going to be glorified. My hour is coming. I'm going to be glorified. I'm going to be lifted up. I'm going to be lifted up. I'm going to be glorified. When my hour comes, I will be lifted up. He uses this language on almost every page of John's gospel. And everyone must have been thinking, I wonder what's that going to look like? You know, is he going to be lifted up on a throne? Lifted up on a stage? And he's lifted up on the cross, with his arms outstretched to the world, bleeding even for his enemies. And this is the Word of God. This is the communication of God. This is God's message for the world. Not commandments in the sky to make you bow, but an arms wide sacrifice who loves you more than his own life. That's an interesting God, isn't it? So when this God shows up after his death, Thomas was not there that first Easter. When Jesus goes through death and out the other side and rises again, for some reason he wasn't there. We're not told where he was. I don't know. He was washing his hair. He was watching Netflix. Who knows what he was doing? He wasn't there when Jesus first rose from the dead. And all his friends are telling him, it's wonderful. You know how Jesus promised he'd rise from the dead? He actually did. And Thomas says, I won't believe it. He's a real skeptic. That's why we call him Doubting Thomas. Do you see it? Verse 24, Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we've seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Gosh, that's a bit extreme, don't you think? I mean, if I'm ever in hospital and you come to visit me and you say, I don't believe you, Glenn. Unless I put my hand into your wounds, I will not be like, please, you have no visiting rights. Just go, leave the grapes and go. Like, I don't want your kind of visit. But Thomas, he's a bit odd, isn't he? He wants to put his hand into Jesus' side, but why? Why does he want that proof? Because he doesn't just want any kind of divine apparition. He wants to know that the very one who went through death is the same one who is victorious over death. He wants to know that the very one who took on the great monster death, that he has triumphed. He wants to know that the one who has loved him to hell and back, that he is in charge of the future. He wants to know that this battle-scarred warrior, Jesus, is back from the dead. He doesn't just want a divine apparition. He doesn't just want to know that there is some kind of life beyond the grave. He wants to know that Jesus is Lord. Because in the Bible, either Jesus is Lord or death is Lord. That's kind of the way it works. That's the logic of it. And it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? If Jesus did not conquer the grave, then death is the victor. Death is the undefeated champion of the world, isn't it? In billions of bouts, death has never lost, right? So unless Jesus has beaten death, death is Lord, right? Does that make sense? I don't know if you're into computer games or that sort of thing. You know, how does the average computer game work? You know, you do one level in the computer game and you get to the end and maybe you've collected enough rings or power-ups or whatever, and you get to the end of level one and you have to face off against a big boss, don't you? Okay, and you blast the big boss, and maybe you beat the big boss. So, level two, and you collect all the rings again, and you get to the big boss at the end of level two, and then you ascend to level three, level four, level five, and then you get to level 10, and it's the ultimate big boss, you know, triple-headed monster, bulletproof, you can't defeat this guy. And in the Bible, death is that big boss. The book of 1 Corinthians chapter 15 says that death is the last enemy. It's the big boss, never lost a battle. Billions of battles, and it's always been the victor. And unless Jesus has conquered death, death is Lord. Do you recognize that? Do you recognize that? That unless this story is true, death is Lord. Death is the thing that swallows up everything, everything good in our lives. It's death that swallows it up, unless this story is true, unless Jesus has slain that dragon. There is a computer game called That Dragon Cancer. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's the most harrowing computer game I've ever played. It's developers were these two parents who had a child called Joel. And aged about four, he was diagnosed with brain cancer. And they decided as game developers that they were going to develop this game that was going to honor Joel. And it was a game about how you're going to slay the dragon cancer. And it was all about, you know, can you find the right consultants and can you find the right chemotherapy and radiotherapy, the right surgical procedures? Can you pray in the right way? Can you seek the right spiritual help and medical help? And can you somehow defeat that dragon cancer? And the great tragedy of this game is that as they were developing it, Joel Ryan, their son, died. But they kept on making the game. But this game then became a very different kind of computer game. You know how in every other computer game, it's always about how you can outsmart the bad guy. And through cunning and wile and perseverance, you manage to get the end and you manage to beat the dragon. In this game, you cannot beat the dragon. And so there's a scene where you're in the doctor's office and the doctor is telling you about your son and he's saying, we've done everything we can. And he starts to talk about excellent end-of-life care. And as he does that, you're trying to say things that will make him change his mind, and you can't do it. And symbolically in the room, water starts filling up and you end up drowning in this scene. There's nothing you can do about it. And it's that kind of a game. There are these immersive vignettes about the realities of life and the realities of death. That dragon, cancer, always wins. In the penultimate scene of the game, you're in this cathedral, and Joel is lying at the front of the cathedral, and you're meant to be able to say the right prayers that are going to save young Joel. And the way you do it is by pressing on the different pipe organ keys, and each key releases a different kind of prayer. And if this was any other computer game, you'd have to get the right combination of those keys and lighting the right combination of candles over here. And if you got just the right combination, somehow the healing would happen, but not in this game. It doesn't matter what you do. And I've watched on YouTube all these YouTubers who are playing this game and they don't understand the game. And you just hear them just yelling out, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And then everything goes black and you realize that Joel has died. That dragon cancer has never lost a battle. And none of our skill or cunning has been able to outfox death. But then, on the screen, there's just this little word, loading, dot, dot, dot. Loading, dot, dot, dot. And then the next scene is you're on this boat and it's crossing a river. And on the far side, there's this sort of paradise scene, this wonderful tropical island. And there's Joel. And he's surrounded by everything he's ever loved in life. He's got his favorite dog yapping around him. He's got pancakes, stack of pancakes next to him. He loves pancakes. And when you get across to the other side, you can blow bubbles at him because he loves bubbles. He's always loved bubbles. And as you blow these bubbles, he's just giggling and giggling and giggling. It's this extraordinary, happily ever after, when nothing you could have done could have stopped this freight train towards death. And yet through death and out the other side, there's this happily ever after. And you know, the developers of this game are actually Christians. And they wanted to give people an experience of what life and death and resurrection feels like. Because you know what it feels like? It feels like we try everything we can do to defeat that dragon cancer and you can't. Nobody can. Nobody ever has. But somehow, could it be that you get that little loading sign? Just loading, loading, loading. Could it be that beyond that enemy that defeats all of us, there is some kind of victory? Could it be that there's someone bigger than death? Could Jesus be Lord? And friends, if Jesus is not Lord, then death is Lord. And there is no final screen. But is Jesus Lord? Is Jesus bigger than death? I want to give you three reasons why you can believe that Jesus is Lord, that he's bigger than death, and that there is a happily ever after. I want to give you these three reasons. And then I'm going to ask whether you can put your trust in this Jesus. Without him, death is Lord. But could Jesus be Lord? Let's think of these three proofs that Jesus is bigger than death. And the first proof is the heavens. The heavens are declaring to you a God who is bigger than death. Everything about reality, everything about the world that you live in is proclaiming to you a God who is bigger than death. Let me just take you through a few different things. Everything's come from nothing. Any scientist will tell you that. Everything has come from nothing. Now, the scientific picture on the right-hand side of the screen, the scientific picture will tell you there's been a virgin birth of the cosmos. Life has come from non-life. There's been this Easter-type miracle, right? Everything's come from nothing. It's the ultimate virgin birth. You know, I believe in the virgin birth of Jesus. This is the virgin birth of the cosmos, but without a virgin, right? Nothing up the sleeve, no magician, just pure magic out of nowhere. Which one do you believe? You see, as a Christian, I believe that there is a God of life from the dead. A God who can bring about such a virgin birth. Everything in this planet, everything on this planet, everything about your existence is telling you that there is a God who is bigger than nothingness, a God who is bigger than the void, a God who is bigger than death. Your very existence tells you that. And if you don't believe in the God of resurrection, if you don't believe in the Easter God, then you have to embrace the real absurdities. That we've all come from nothing, a virgin birth of the cosmos. Everything has come from nothing. And then secondly, order has come from chaos. Every scientist will tell you that the universe had a beginning, but you know, explosions don't tend to order things very finely, do they? You know, when my mother told me that my room looked like a bomb hit it, she was not complimenting me. She was not telling me that my room was finely ordered for the preservation of life, and yet this world is extremely fine-tuned for the preservation of life. Don't know if you've ever looked into the fine-tuning of the universe, but from this explosion, let me just give you one fact about this explosion. You know, if the rate of expansion from the Big Bang was too fast, we would fling out into heat death. And if the rate of expansion from the Big Bang was too slow, we'd crunch back in on ourselves. But it happens to be just right. Yeah, not too fast, not too slow, just right. So what is this Goldilocks range? Well, scientists crunch the numbers and they tell you the Goldilocks range is 1 in 10 to the power 120. Okay? For non-scientists among us, that's a 1 with 120 zeros after it. 1 over 1 with 120 zeros in it. There's only 10 to the power 80 atoms in the universe. Okay? This, to call this number astronomical is ridiculous. No. We are finely poised in this world. A lot of people at that point say, oh yes, I know that the Earth is finely poised, but there are trillions of Earth-type planets out there. I'm not saying that the Earth is finely poised. I'm saying that the cosmos is finely poised. The only cosmos that we can observe is incredibly poised on a razor's edge. There's been order from chaos. How do you believe in that? You know, I believe in the miracles of Jesus, right? I believe that Jesus went around and he brought order out of chaos. People who couldn't see things and he made them able to see. People who had diseases, he was able to bring order out of that chaos. But I believe in a Lord of life who is able to do that. Why would you believe that this universe is ordered out of chaos, but you've got no Jesus to do it for you? No God of Easter, no God of life over death to be able to do it for you. Now, the very ordered nature of this universe tells you that there is a God of life over death, the Easter kind of God, or life from non-life. You know, I mean, I believe that Jesus came back to life again in that Jerusalem tomb. After 3 days, the non-living Jesus lived again. That's a miracle. What an incredible miracle. But if I didn't believe in God, I would have to believe that all life, emerged from inorganic chemicals and without a God of resurrection to effect the miracle. Sure, as a Christian, I believe in miracles. I believe in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. But when you get rid of this God and then you believe that there's been life from non-life, well, why can you believe that miracle and you can't believe the Jesus miracle? At least the Jesus miracle has a God to work it. Who is the God who is working your miracle if life is coming from non-life? You see, yes, Christians believe in miracles, but I would say that the atheistic worldview is orders of magnitude more improbable than the Christian one. And that to embrace the materialistic philosophy of atheism is to embroil yourself in absurdities that go far beyond anything that the religions of the world have ever contemplated. Yes, the non-living Jesus came back to life on Easter Sunday. I do believe that. But we all believe in life from non-life. I just believe that there's a God of Easter, a God of life over death, who can work such a miracle. And I think there's good reason to believe in such a God. Or what about this one? Minds from mindless matter. It's very hard to even contemplate how chemistry, brain chemistry, the water of brain chemistry is translated into the wine of consciousness. That was a phrase that's used actually by an atheistic philosopher in Australia, that we don't even know how the water of brain chemistry translates into the wine of consciousness. How do we believe in that kind of life over death miracle? Well, I would just suggest to you that a God of life over death, the Easter kind of God, makes sense of all these most basic facts about reality. Everything's come from nothing. Order has come from chaos. Life has come from non-life. And minds have come from mindless matter. All of that makes sense because I think there is a God of Easter. So the heavens, I think, are declaring to you this kind of Easter God. But now let's go from the heavens and zoom down into history. Let me give you another reason why you can believe in the Easter God. The history of things. Now, any kind of first century historian worth their salt can agree to the basic facts of Jesus' life and death. Okay, so there was this figure, Jesus of Nazareth, who was very popular. He was wildly popular at times, wildly unpopular at other times. In around AD 30, he caused a disturbance in the Jerusalem area. He was arrested. He was tried by both the religious authorities of the Jews and the secular authorities of the Romans. He was put to death on a capital charge. He was killed. He was placed in a tomb, a public tomb, the whereabouts of which were known to all people. And 3 days later, that tomb was empty. The body was never found. And his followers all had experiences of meeting the risen Christ, which lasted for 40 days and then stopped when they said that Jesus had returned to heaven. Those are the facts, whether you're an atheist historian, whether you're a Christian historian, Jewish historian, those seem to be the facts, broadly speaking. How do you account for those facts? You can come up with different explanations. Maybe Jesus didn't quite die on the cross, and somehow he only swooned on the cross, and he revived himself in the cool of the tomb, and then somehow moved a massive great stone and overpowered a Roman guard and appeared to his disciples in a semi-crucified state to, you know, engender great, you know, belief in the powers of resurrection. And somehow that is what births the Christian movement. You can start to make up stories like that. But again, they embroil you in more absurdities than the Christian story, right? This is the history. The history is that Jesus died. He was placed in a tomb. That tomb was empty. The body was never found. People saw Jesus. And then the really interesting thing, I think, from that point of view, is that from that moment, historically, there has been a big bang. Historically speaking, the world's most significant sociological movement began on Easter Sunday. And, you know, the way you understand about a Big Bang is that you see an expanding universe and you just wind the clock back and there must have been a Big Bang, right? And look at the church today. It is the most diverse sociological movement the world has ever seen. It's bigger today than it was yesterday. It'll be bigger again tomorrow. It'll be bigger again the day after. There's been this massive expanding phenomenon, and you trace it back. What was the Big Bang? Something went bang on Easter Sunday. Something transformed these losers like Thomas into people who turned the world upside down. I mean, Thomas is just a really odd human being, don't you think? He's this unschooled nobody under the thumb of Rome. And after this event, he ends up going to India. And there's incredible exploits by the church. These absolute nobodies who are following a total loser called Jesus, who, if he's not the Son of God, he's just choked to death in his early 30s. How do you explain the world's largest sociological phenomenon? There's been a Big Bang. What explains the Big Bang? History tells you something was unleashed. Seems to me the most obvious explanation is the one that Jesus keeps on insisting on. That Jesus is indeed who he says he is. He's God come to earth to take on that dragon called death, to slay it and to rise again. So I'd say the heavens tell you Jesus is Lord. History tells you Jesus is Lord. And then the third H, him. The heavens, history, and him. Have you ever just looked at Jesus? Have you ever just taken the time to pick up one of these gospel accounts of Jesus and just gotten to know him? Because when you do, you start to see that this Jesus is incredible. And you can start to play that game that kids sometimes play. You know how kids sort of say, you know, who would win in a fight between this superhero and that superhero? You know, kids do that. Who would win between this guy and that guy, right? Well, you know what you can do? You can pick up the Gospels and you can look at Jesus and you can start to play that sort of game. And you can start to say to yourself, who would win in a fight between death and Jesus? And you go into it with your eyes wide open because you know that death has never lost a battle, right? You know that death is the undefeated champion of the world, right? But then you start to encounter Jesus in his word and you start to say to yourself, I think death has met its match. I think there is something bigger than death. I think his name is Jesus. And as he starts to reveal himself to you, you start to realize Jesus is Lord, not death. Jesus is Lord. It creeps up on you. And as soon as you start to say Jesus is Lord, bad luck, you're a Christian, right? It just sneaks up on you like that. You might be fighting it, but when you see who he is, when you encounter his divine glory, you start to say, I think he is the eternal Son of God come to planet Earth. And if he's the eternal Son of God come to planet Earth, it would be extraordinary if he didn't rise from the dead, right? Actually, through opening this book and encountering Jesus, you can come to see that he is Lord. Because that's how it happens here. Do you see this? In verse 26, a week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. I love that. You know, all his friends, they left him for dead. All his friends, they'd either deserted, denied, or betrayed him. And now Jesus tracks them down from beyond the grave. That's interesting, isn't it? These people, they've left him for dead. He tracks them down from beyond the grave. And is he going to exact vengeance? The very opposite. He comes to say, peace, peace. And then he says to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. And you say to yourself, I want to have a Thomas experience. Wouldn't you like to have a Thomas experience? I mean, imagine if we arranged for it tonight. Tonight at All Souls, you know. That would top having Mary Berry, wouldn't it? Right? Tonight at All Souls, Jesus of Nazareth. And he came in all his divine glory and he showed you his hands and his side. Wouldn't that give you such a thrill? Wouldn't that just give you a real boost for about a fortnight? Be amazing, wouldn't it? And you go to work tomorrow and you'd say, it's pretty good at All Souls. Yeah, last night they had Jesus, right? And what are they going to say in the office, right? Like, what are they putting the cakes? What's going on at All Souls? Like, and you know, within 2 weeks you'd have to see Jesus again, wouldn't you? And then again. And then again, and then again. It's interesting what Jesus does here. Verse 29, then Jesus told him, because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And you think, well, how? I haven't seen Jesus, so I can be blessed? Okay, Jesus, how can I believe in you without seeing you? The verses go on. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. I want to believe in Jesus. I can't see him. How do I believe? These things are written that you may believe. You know why the Bible's being given to you? The Bible's being given to you so that you can have a Thomas experience. so that you can encounter the risen Jesus. You can see his scars. Because his scars tell a scar story, don't they? All scars tell a scar story. I often speak with teenagers and I ask, do you have any scars? Do you have any scar stories? And all the boys are very keen at that point to show me their scars. And, what's the story with this? And all scar stories, they happen the same. It's like I was going along happily in life and then I encountered the force of gravity or the cricket ball or the black run at Val d'Isère. And then crash, and you tell about how painful it was. And then you say, but I'm okay now and I've got the scar to prove the story. Did you know that God's got a scar story? That's interesting. God's got a scar story. And his story runs the same. Everything was going fine until I encountered planet Earth. And it was really painful. I was the Word of God and they shut me up on that cross. I was the light of the world and they extinguished me on that cross. I was the fountain of life and they killed me. But I rose up again to bring peace to my friends. And I've got the scars to prove the story. And this book has been written so that you can have a Thomas experience. You can encounter Jesus in his scars. Have you done that? Have you come to see who Jesus is in his scars? There's a famous image of this scene, Caravaggio, who was an interesting character himself, quite Thomas-like in a lot of ways. My friend at the start, he said, if the stars rearranged, then I'd believe. What's the real proof that would make me believe? The stars. The real proof that would make you believe? It's the scars. The scars of Jesus. Because they are battle scars that are assuring you of a love that has taken Jesus to hell and back for you. Is this the kind of God that you can believe in? He's a God who's bigger than death. And he's slain that dragon cancer. He's slain that dragon called death. He's risen up for you. Do you see him? Do you know him? Do you think of him as Lord? Then you're having a Thomas experience. And in that Thomas experience, you start to say, my Lord and my God. Is that starting to happen to you? You're starting to see that Jesus is Lord? If it is, then rejoice. Rejoice. Jesus is calling you to himself. Let's put this up on the screen if I can. There's a prayer I want to put up on the screen that you can say if you want to recognize Jesus as my Lord and my God, the way that Thomas did. There's a prayer that just says, Jesus, I've seen how you've given yourself for me. I'm yours. I'm yours through life and death and into eternity. In a second, I'm going to pray it. For now, I just want to read it out to you so you know what it says. And you can think to yourself, do I recognize Jesus as my Lord and my God? The prayer just says this. Dear Jesus, I recognize who you are. You are Lord and you are light. I, on the other hand, am lost in the dark. I need you. Thank you for dying for me. Thank you for rising to give me new life. Please forgive me for my sin and selfishness. Come into my life and lead me through this life and into eternity. Is that something that you could say to Jesus even this evening? Let's think about that as we think some more about the love of God, and then I'll come back and we'll pray it. Is this something that you can say to Jesus as he has given himself to you with every drop of his blood? Can you say to him, I'm yours? Can you call him my Lord and my God? I'm just going to pray these words. The words are not magic. They're just a way that you could start responding to the love of Jesus. I'm going to pray them out loud. You can echo them silently in your hearts if they're true for you. Let's pray. Dear Jesus, I recognize who you are. You are Lord and you are light. I, on the other hand, am lost in the dark. I need you. Thank you for dying for me. Thank you for rising to give me new life. Please forgive me for my sin and selfishness. Come into my life and lead me through this life and into eternity. Amen. If you've prayed that kind of prayer, perhaps for the first time, or perhaps you're returning to Jesus to call him Lord and God in a significant way, then I'd love to meet you afterwards. I'll just be here after the service. I'd love to give you a little book that will help you take these first steps in the Christian life. And I'd just urge you to talk to somebody who you know here and tell them that you want to follow Jesus, because following Jesus is not a solo sport. It's a team sport, and we need to help one another. I'd also urge you to come along tomorrow night to the Why Easter course and just get grounded in the basics of why Jesus came, why he died, and the glorious good news that he rose again. So do please shake me by the hand at the end. But thanks so much for listening.